From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
San Mateo.
San Francisco, Mission Dolores Park.
Financial District near the Tenderloin.
San Bruno.
North Sunnyvale.
Downtown Palo Alto.
Coming up, how San Francisco plans to move the Super Bowl festivities onto the streets that some people call home.
You know, I know the Super Bowl is a game, but, you know, we're not really into playing games with folks who are destitute.
Then we'll hear what the incoming director of the San Francisco Tenants Union thinks about increasing affordable housing in the city.
First of all, we need to not lose what we have. Somebody who's currently living in housing that they can afford is living in affordable housing right now.
And we'll hear what it's like to sing in a senior choir.
You feel elated, you know, because you are able, you know, to be in unity with other voices.
The importance of building a home today on Cross Currents. Super Bowl 50 is about to touch down in the Bay Area. And while the game is taking place in Santa Clara, San Franciscans will host many of the visiting fans and fanfare. Starting this Sunday, a very temporary, very commercial event center will pop up on the last four blocks of Market Street and across the waterfront. It's called Super Bowl City, presented by Verizon. The area will be blocked off for a seven-day festival of games, food, and marketing gimmicks. It's open to the public, but apparently that doesn't mean everyone is allowed to be there. In August, Mayor Ed Lee told a San Francisco Chronicle reporter that homeless people will have to move elsewhere.
You're going to have to leave, and we'll give you an alternative, and we're always going to be supportive, but you're going to have to leave the streets.
So, what does Super Bowl City presented by Verizon mean for San Francisco's homeless? KLW's Liza Veal has that story.
If Mayor Lee could remove all homeless people from the streets of San Francisco in time for the Super Bowl, it would mean he was either a miracle worker or a criminal mastermind. But that's not what he actually said.
So the mayor never made an announcement about that?
Sam Dodge runs the city's Hope Office on Homelessness.
Phil Mateer pulled something out of context and sold a lot of newspapers, right? And that's why you're asking me about it, right? So it works.
Here's what the mayor meant. Homeland Security will seal off a zone around the 13-block Super Bowl City area, checking IDs and bags as people enter. So no one will be allowed to stay after hours. According to Dodge, there's only 8 to 12 people who regularly sleep on the streets there, including this woman.
Мухаметшина, Марина.
We're outside the Embarcadero BART station at around 10 at night. There are a few people in suits rushing underground to commute back home. And there are folks like Shamiliana and her friend who are sticking around. They carry bags and blankets and make their way down Market Street looking for a good spot to camp out. She knows she'll have to go elsewhere next week.
They're just going to try to seal off this whole area.
I know. We've been kicking my homeless people from this area. I'm trying to clean it up.
Rude.
Police is rude as hell.
Do people not want to leave this area? Is there something like special about this area?
It's special. Yeah. It's view. It's close to water.
It's also well lit with a lot of activity, so it feels safer, but it's not residential, so Shamiliana doesn't feel like she's really bothering anybody. She says she expects to be off the street in a month or so anyway. Bouncing in and out of housing is something she's used to. She's been doing it for a decade. She says finding somewhere else next week is not a big deal for her. But it's a big deal to Jennifer Friedenbach. The executive director of the Coalition on Homelessness says a simple-sounding relocation can escalate for the people being moved around.
They'll just have the police come. They'll confiscate people's properties. They'll spray down their sleeping areas. They ticket people, they do unlawful searches of their property, they run warrant checks on them, they arrest them. When they give them tickets, they can't pay them. Those go to warrant, it destroys their credit, they get kicked off of the housing wait list. It's just a nightmare for everyone.
She says she saw this kind of treatment in September when the same area was cleared for a Super Bowl pre-party. Other Super Bowl host cities have faced similar challenges preparing for the game. In 2013, New Orleans police forcibly dispersed homeless encampments, opening temporary shelters and closing them the day after the game. Indianapolis, on the other hand, conducted outreach to bring its homeless population into shelters prior to the game in 2012 and didn't interfere with those who declined. In San Francisco, temporary shelters have opened up in rec centers, churches, and nonprofit centers like St. Anthony's, all along the Southeast neighborhoods and the Western Addition.
I'm standing outside of a temporary shelter they've set up for the winter in the St. Anthony's Foundation in the Tenderloin. And there's about a dozen people lined up. And I'm going to head inside.
And can I get your name?
Sure. I'm Brooks Bajero.
Can you just like describe like where we are just for the tape for people who can't see it?
Sure. We have mats on the floor, fresh mats, basically like 60 plus mats, blankets, socks given out. And we got people working here that are actually security, keeping everything safe and cool.
The city is preparing to add 1,100 beds this winter, temporarily doubling its capacity. They're not all available yet because there are still a lot of vacancies. That's the thing. Even though we don't have a bed for every person on the street, we have spare beds. That's because many, if not most people, prefer to avoid shelters.
Can I ask, how long do you think you'll stay here?
I'm not sure.
Hope director Sam Dodge says he wants to make shelters viable and attractive so folks at Justin Herman Plaza are not put out by the festivities. But really, he's got more on his mind this winter.
Me, I'm not concerned about the Super Bowl. I'm concerned about El Nino.
That's the real reason for the big shelter overhaul.
I think that everyone's aware of the extra media attention the Super Bowl brings, and I think it becomes a metaphor, right? When we talk about homelessness and Super Bowl, we're not talking about homelessness and the Super Bowl. We're talking about anxiety, about the future of San Francisco, and whether this is a place that we're all going to enjoy or if this is going to be a Disneyland for the rich. And so I think that that's really the discussion that's happening, and it really has less to do with the actual interactions between police and the homeless.
It's not just a metaphor when the city is spending public money, though. The city now estimates it will spend about $5 million, mostly on transportation and police. Mayor Lee promises the city will make more than that back in sales and hotel taxes during the event.
San Francisco's still leading industry is tourism.
And Dodge adds that because tourism has grown recently, the city's budget has too.
We're making historic investments in homeless services, and I think that's something everyone can be really proud of. San Francisco invests more general fund dollars in homeless services than any other city that I know of in the United States, and I follow this pretty closely. We're big kids. We can walk and chew gum at the same time.
San Francisco spends about $130 million annually on direct homeless services. That's 1.5% of its total budget. Dodge thinks his department will be overprepared to weather El Nino. He's ready to get back to his main focuses, engaging new populations through the Mission Navigation Center and connecting more people to services and permanent housing. While Super Bowl City, presented by Verizon, is directly displacing maybe a dozen people, San Francisco's Hope Office has thousands of others to think about. In San Francisco, I'm Liza Veal for Cross Currents.
Do you think San Francisco is acting responsibly with its homeless population? Let us know what you think at 415-264-7106 and leave a message. That's 415-264-7106, and we may share your thoughts on the air. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Uncertainty around housing in San Francisco also extends to those who currently have a place in the city. According to a report by the San Francisco Rent Board, efforts to evict tenants are at a 10-year high, with more than 2,000 eviction notices filed in 2015. Those people can find help at the San Francisco Tenants Union. Ted Gullickson led the nonprofit for more than two decades until he passed away in October 2014. This month, Deepa Varma took the helm of the organization. She sat down to talk with KALW's Audrey Dilling.
What sort of experiences are you bringing to this new role?
I feel like I'm actually a little bit more conventional in some ways than Ted. I went to law school. I'm a younger social justice advocate and public servant. So I have to learn how to be that different kind of radical. One thing that I think me and Ted share is optimism. I think a lot of times people look at the housing crisis and look at gentrification as a totally unwinnable fight, and Ted never treated that job that way, and I think I don't either.
If you were the president giving a State of the Union address, sort of, how would you say what's the state of tenancy in San Francisco right now? Is it strong? Is it not?
It's mixed, right? I think that our protections are as strong as they have been since I've been working on tenant rights in San Francisco, which was 4 years ago. It's one of those times that when everybody is talking about tenant rights and thinking about it and improving their knowledge of the issues. Of course, that's because the pressure is on.
What would you say are the top things that people are coming to the tenants union for?
Well, I would say that we're seeing an uptick in owner move-in notices that are clearly bogus. Situations where a landlord, for example, I'll give you an example, is moving from a three-bedroom apartment in the East Bay into a one-bedroom apartment in the Mission. And it just doesn't seem like that would make sense.
And owner move-in, is that not the same as the Ellis Act?
It isn't. This is actually one of the big ways that we've been hoodwinked in recent years as San Francisco residents. So there's several different ways a landlord can evict a tenant when the tenant did nothing wrong themselves. And they are distinct. They have different requirements. One of them is owner move-in, where the owner buys a place and wants to move in themselves or move a relative in themselves. And that person has to be a relative. And that person, it has to be in good faith. Although we've definitely seen a lot of situations in which landlords are doing this not in good faith. An Ellis Act eviction is one in which the landlord allegedly goes out of the business of being a landlord altogether. And with an owner move-in, it's about one unit. With an Ellis Act, it's about the whole building. So when landlords testify about how they want to keep the Ellis Act because they want to be able to move in their relative, they're actually lying, that they already have another mechanism for doing that.
Is it fair to expect a landlord to rent a building forever?
Well, here's the thing. A landlord can sell the building. They don't necessarily have to continue being the landlord forever. I don't think that there's anything preventing them from selling the building.
I'm speaking with Deepa Varma, incoming director of the San Francisco Tenants Union. And one of the biggest things coming through related to affordable housing coming to the Planning Commission is the Affordable Housing Bonus Program. That's a program put forward by Ed Lee and Supervisor Katie Tang, which would allow developers to build two levels higher than an area is zoned if they provide 30% affordable housing. And I think and three levels higher if it's 100% affordable. That's something that the tenants union has come out opposed to. How come?
We have a lot of concerns about the density bonus program. It's basically been pushed by the mayor's office without any input from community groups, without any input from the supervisors, and in an extremely undemocratic way. And the whole idea is to give major economic incentives to developers and reduce the barriers that usually exist. Not just barriers, but the protections we have from bad things happening, basically environmental reviews and the permitting process. All of that is streamlined so that there's less checks on what happens. We are not opposed to building affordable housing. The issue is doing that in a way where there's no review and where the people behind it are the people who are paid for by the developer, who are funded by the developers and who are have been the tools of those developers is really suspect. I mean, what we're talking about basically is knocking down existing affordable housing in the form of rent control to build other affordable housing that might not actually meet the same needs of those people who are displaced. And there's no accounting for what those people are going to do in the meantime. If people are gone for 3 years, they may never come back to San Francisco. In the meantime, we're going to have a bunch of new units and who knows what level of affordability. I mean, I myself and my own income don't qualify for most affordable housing built in the city right now. So we really need to know those numbers. And to the fact that it's happened in, behind closed doors this way is really kind of horrifying.
What is the right way to bring more affordable housing to San Francisco?
Well, first of all, we need to not lose what we have, right? Somebody who's currently living in housing that they can afford is living in affordable housing right now. So every time one of those units is lost, we have to account for the attrition rather than just think about building. Secondly, we need to have policies in place that don't encourage the further loss of those units. For example, short-term rentals are a growing problem in the city. The numbers are now anywhere from, I mean, the low estimates are 5,000. There's estimates at 10,000 units just on Airbnb, let alone VRBO and corporate rentals and other kinds of uses of what should be rent-controlled housing being used for commercial purposes.
And you mentioned short-term rentals. That's another thing that was a big issue in the recent election with Prop F. What's your strategy now for trying to curb that problem?
There is a major campaign still underway to deal with the issue. It's an issue internationally at this point. But Airbnb is headquartered right here in San Francisco, and this is the center of the sharing economy in a lot of ways. And so a lot of people are looking to what San Francisco is going to do to deal with it. There is an effort to try to write new legislation about it, to try to address some of the concerns with the last go-around. But really, one of the big issues is that we're being outspent by the other side, who has a significant monetary interest in keeping things the way they are and keeping the alleged regulations that exist unenforceable. So we've got a challenge ahead of us, but people are beginning to understand the problem more and more, I think.
You mentioned being an optimist. What are some of the things that give you hope about housing in San Francisco?
I think that while the crisis has gotten really, really bad, one of the things that means is that more people see themselves as part of the struggle. It's an organizing opportunity, honestly. Every time I speak to a journalist, they talk about how hard it was for them to find housing. Even high-end restaurants are closing because they can't find a workforce. Teachers, of course, have been out in force on this issue. The same is true for city workers. So this is not an issue for the very low income and the very low income alone at this point. It's something that affects all San Franciscans. It affects even people who are homeowners, because if they want their children to have a teacher, if they want their neighbors to still be there, if they want some continuity in their neighborhood, they have to support tenants right now.
That was Deepa Varma, the new executive director of the San Francisco Tenants Union. She spoke with KALW's Audrey Dilling. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Having a stable community can be just as important as having a stable home. 3 years ago, UCSF initiated a clinical trial to study the impact that singing in a choir can have on older adults. The Community of Voices study follows several choirs that meet for weekly rehearsals and occasional performances. It builds on previous work by gerontologist Dr. Jean Cohen around creativity, the arts, and aging, according to lead researcher Julene Johnson.
He found that older adults who sang in the choir for a year had fewer falls, they had fewer over-the-counter medications, their morale was higher, and there was a hint that their depressive symptoms were less than the control group.
The Community of Voices study won't be completed until 2017, but choir participants are already reporting benefits to their physical, mental, and emotional health from the weekly singing groups. The 30th Street Senior Center Choir in San Francisco is one of seven sponsored by the Community Music Center. The group sings in Spanish, English, and Tagalog. We asked three members to tell us more.
My name is Estela Moreno, and I am 66 years old.
I am Olinda Marti Volkov, and I am 73 years old.
My name is Lupe Bravo, and I'm 83 years old. I have always loved to sing from the time I was a little girl.
Actually, I have never sang before, not even in the shower, because I never thought that I had a voice at all.
I mean, we start with a song that I've never heard, and by the hour, we're all singing it. Monday morning is the happiest day of my life because I know I'm going to get up early and I'm going to go to the center and I'm going to have an hour and a half of wonderful teachers and wonderful people that are part of the choir.
A lot of the people that come and sing, they tell me that they don't do much other than the rest of the week, so they really look forward to this Monday choir rehearsal because they have a place to go. So they get ready even from Sunday, you know, what they're going to wear. So in anticipation.
The sense of camaraderie, you know, enjoyment, and you feel elated, you know, because you are able, you know, to be in unity with other voices. You know, you're all together, you know, and you become friends.
La Martiniana is my favorite song because it talks about when I die, don't cry, sing for me, and then I won't be floating around you. It's a very beautiful, sentimental song, and I get emotional every time we sing it.
You know, the thing about this song is that you're also thinking about your own, you know. When you get to be a certain age, then you start thinking about your own mortality. And I think, you know, listening to this song, it makes you think about that because it makes you think of all your loved ones, all your family, your children, if you have any. And you're thinking, oh my gosh, you know, how are they going to feel, you know, when I'm gone? And this song, you know, expresses those feelings, you know, don't cry for me. It is, you know, it is a wonderful thing, you know, to be able to be among all these, you know, men and women at the, you know, at the choir.
You make new friends, and you see each other on a personal level, too. One little lady that comes in, always a little late because she has to wait for her van, and she tries to make it. As long as she can still feel strong, that woman is there.
The first time that we sang at one of our presentations that we do is at the Day of the Death Symphony, at the Symphony Hall, mm-hmm. Davies. And the first year that she went, I took her. I picked her up at home, you know, and I took her. When she saw that building and when she walked into that, she'd never been. Never been. She was in awe. So she sat and like way up on the first tier one as we walked in. Right there on the first seat. And from there, she stood there with her walker and she was like, I've never been. And it was just, for me, it was like, oh my God, it was the most rewarding thing, you know, to see that this, she was 92 then, 92 year old, you know, having this reaction to a place that she's never been and what the singing did for her.
When I see her come in, I'm just, it's just, you know, there's always something that we can do no matter what age. And she still comes. And that's my future. That inspires me to continue doing and giving.
Those were the voices of Lupe Bravo, Estela Moreno, and Olinda Marti Volkoff of the 30th Street Senior Center Choir. That piece was produced by Jen Chien. You can hear them perform at Community Music Center's Older Adult Choir Summit. That's tomorrow afternoon at 2:30 at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco. And you'll find that information at kalw.org. Click Cross Currents. And we'd love to hear from you. Email us at news@kalw.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hoff, Angela Johnston, Troop Nguyen, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by James Rollins. The line producer was Jeremy Dalmas. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Quillis and Cloud. They started as a duo in 2011 playing the streets of San Francisco. But this Thursday, they'll be at the Freight and Salvage in Berkeley starting at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.
Wake from a dream where there was no time.